On this show, we cover what happens in the hardest moments. But there's another side to every story. The people who show up. The ones who run toward crisis, who stop the bleeding, who bring people back. Doctors, nurses, first responders, the people who hold the line. Most of them, they wear FIGS. Because FIGS makes scrubs designed for performance. Lightweight, breathable, with four-way stretch and smart, functional details, like moisture-wicking, antimicrobial fabric, and pockets where you actually need them. If you work in healthcare or love someone who does, you know how much that matters. Get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX for 15% off. Can you believe our country is turning 250? When it comes to furniture worthy of America's 250th birthday, Bob's has the styles all Americans want at the everyday low prices we deserve. Plus, everything is backed by glowing five-star reviews from real customers. For ultimate relaxation, check out the Sedona Power Reclining Sofa. It's a genuine leather dream with built-in charging and Bob-O-Pedic seats made for chilling in the AC all day. You can even grab the matching love seat and recliner. If you're hosting summer parties, the Homeworks dining set is a must-have, offering comfy Bob-O-Pedic seating and hidden storage in both the table and bench. For maximum flexibility, the modular Bob sectional is a customer favorite with over 1,000 five-star reviews. It features family-proof construction, wireless charging, and Bob-O-Pedic memory foam for hundreds less than competitors. It's just $250 per piece. It's a total steal. Celebrate the 4th at Bob's. It's where America shops for furniture. Welcome back to Postmortem. I'm your host, 48 Hours correspondent Anne-Marie Green, and joining me today to discuss the season premiere episode of 48 Hours is 48 Hours correspondent Erin Moriarty. Erin, how many seasons has it been for you now?
Okay, I was trying to count, and I think it's 35, which means isn't this your first full season? So you
it
have
is.
A little bit to catch up with me.
All right, I'm working on it. Still, with all those seasons under your belt, this is quite an episode. I don't know if you've done anything like this one before. It's the perplexing case of Ben Elliott. He murdered his twin sister, Megan, in 2021. They were both just 17 years old at the time. Now, Ben maintains his innocence. He admits that he stabbed his sister, but he says he was sleepwalking and he did not intend to harm her. So this is one of those episodes, Erin, that throughout the hour, my mind kept on changing about whether or not, you know, I felt it was intentional. I felt that, you know, whether or not he was guilty, I couldn't really decide.
You know, Anne-Marie, I'm with you. I was conflicted as well. When I first started on the story, I thought, well, that's a novel defense, you know, but I thought of it as a defense. But I have really gone 180. The problem here is our criminal judicial system that is based on adversarial sides, the courts want to find guilt or innocence, guilt or not guilty. In this case, we know he did it. He, you know, Ben Elliott admits he stabbed his sister, but we don't know why or if he intended to. And the other problem with this case, which you and I will talk about, is this is a young man who never shows a lot of emotion.
Absolutely. We will get into his demeanor. But before we even sort of get into the case, we'll just remind people that if you haven't actually listened to this episode of 48 Hours, you can do so. You can find the full audio version just below this episode that you're listening to in your podcast feed. Go take a listen and then come on back for this conversation. Okay. You actually have a pretty unique perspective here. You are a twin, which I'm just learning.
I am a twin. I have a twin sister. We are not identical, but we are very close. And so this case hit me hard. It was hard not to look at this case as a twin. I can't in a million years imagine hurting my twin. It's the person I knew before anybody. And in this case, there didn't seem to be any problem between these two people. So how do you make sense of that?
Yes, the prosecution argues that Ben intentionally killed his sister and that he wasn't sleepwalking, that this was just sort of an excuse, something that he made up. But they never really established a motive. And me, as the viewer slash juror watching this, that bothered me.
What was so troubling about this case is that not only was there no evidence of a motive or a problem between these twins, everyone that the prosecution talked to said that Ben loved his sister and loved being her protector. She had been diagnosed as autistic, and he, according to the witnesses, wanted to protect her. But here's something else to think about. They couldn't find any evidence on either one of the twins' phones. You would think if there was a problem between the two, there'd be some kind of text trail. Another thing, this is a young man who used his phone all the time. If he was just going to use sleepwalking as a defense, an excuse, wouldn't you think he'd do some research? Well, they didn't find any. So I found this all so troubling because, again, the prosecutors say he's a danger to society. That's right. Why they charged him with first degree and fought to get him convicted of first degree murder. And yet there's no evidence other than the act itself, which is pretty awful, that he really intended to do this.
Mm-hmm. I think that that would have helped me as I was watching the hour if they could give me the why, even though they don't really have to. But the other thing that I kept on thinking about as I was watching the hour is just how much do you know about sleepwalking? I think immediately what comes to mind is sort of this visual of this person walking with their eyes closed and their arms out, sort of zombie-like, not, you know, somebody doing sort of complicated tasks. But I have to say, I have heard some crazy things about people, you know, it could be an urban myth, but I mean, cooking a turkey while sleepwalking and that, all that sort of stuff.
Well, you know, it's not crazy for someone to actually cook while they're sleeping. I learned that. So just so that people understand what it is, there's a large category called parasomnias, and sleepwalking is one of those. So is sleep eating, or if you want to say sleep cooking. And it really happens, and it's more common than I realized it is. But crimes committed while you're sleepwalking is less common, although it does happen. Here's the real problem, Anne-Marie, and it was a problem reporting on this. There are usually no witnesses to somebody sleepwalking. And so they sometimes have to kind of guess about what happens during those episodes. So we have experts, because they were used in the trial, both on the defense side and on the prosecution side. And both sides agree that parasomnia, sleepwalking, does occur. They also agree when it occurs. It occurs during a period of your sleep, which is non-REM, slow wave sleep. And it's when you're almost like in a twilight zone between sleep and being awake. But then the experts disagree. And here's the problem. You have the defense witness saying that there are pockets of memory, and that's why Ben Elliott could remember stabbing. But the state's witness says there are no pockets of memory. The fact that he could remember stabbing his sister meant he was not sleepwalking.
And, you know, what we're talking about here, too, is not just sort of like stumbling around your bedroom, right? We're talking about a very violent act. Do the experts have any opinion on what might cause someone who's normally not violent to act out violently in their sleep?
Dr. Pressman, the prosecution's sleep expert, said that something has to happen to the sleepwalker. Somebody has to interfere with their movement. But again, because in most of these cases, there are no cameras, no witnesses. They don't know exactly we don't know what happened in that bedroom. Did Megan wake up? Did she put a hand up to try to stop him? We don't know.
Dr. Pressman, he said something along the lines of, you know, he knew that he wasn't sleepwalking because he came out of it quickly. And I just sort of thought, how did he know how quickly he came out of it? Because there were only two people in that room, and it certainly wasn't the expert.
Exactly. He's claiming that the fact that Ben said, "I remember stabbing her," meant that he had come out quickly to have that kind of memory. Dr. Pressman says he shouldn't have any memory of it. The prosecution actually used the fact that Ben had some memory against him by saying that Ben had actually killed his sister earlier and had time to come up with a story and then calling 911. Again, as you point out, Emery, there were no cameras, there were no witnesses. We don't know, and the experts don't know.
Mm-hmm. So here's kind of like my journey with Ben, right? Initially, I just thought, you know, his presentation is a little odd, and it starts with that 911 call. At this point, you've listened probably to hundreds of 911 calls. You know, sometimes people are frantic and yelling. Sometimes they are very measured and controlled. They want to get the information out. Ben had this soft, whispery voice. It just was a little odd.
Well, and it was odd to the prosecutors. That was part of the trial. In fact, the prosecutor imitated the phone call in front of the jurors and was whispering. And that's fair to an extent, because certainly when you listen, as you did, Amory, it does sound like he's whispering, and he may have been. But I also want to point out that when I met Ben Elliott in the jail and interviewed him, he is very soft-spoken.
Yeah.
And he doesn't show a lot of emotion. And what he said to me was that he wasn't whispering, that that's how he talks.
But then why didn't he scream out to his parents? That was the other thing that kind of bothered me. I thought, like, why is it that the parents are finding out what's happening? You know, when the cops are showing up, like, why wouldn't he say, "Oh, my God, help me"?
Well, you know what, Emery, that is such a good question. And it's certainly what the prosecution pointed out. Like, why did he call 911? Why did he keep his voice down? He didn't want his parents to know. And that's possible. But can I just point out, here's where my experience as a twin comes in. When you are a twin, whether you're identical or not, you have a real closeness. That is who you share everything with. And I just want to throw out that possibility that as a twin, he was calling 911 because he was thinking of his sister and then didn't think about calling his parents until the 911 operator asked him to. It's a possibility. As a twin, I see that as a possibility.
I think the other thing that really surprised me about this episode is just how many people are familiar with sleepwalking. Because I kind of went through, it's nowhere close to sleepwalking, but my husband talks in his sleep. And when we first met, it would be sort of this mumbly stuff that I couldn't understand, but it's definitely progressed over time. But I mean, one of the prosecutors was a sleepwalker, her children, jurors knew sleepwalkers. I was like, how many people are sleepwalking? And then I also thought, could that have an impact on, you know, whether or not they thought he was guilty or innocent? Because I don't know. Do you know if their familiarity with sleepwalking had an impact on how they decided this case?
I think, Emery, it was a double-edged sword. In one hand, it helped the defense because you had jurors who knew that sleepwalking exists, and they heard during the trial that Ben seemed to have a history of sleepwalking. The other side of that sword is, though, that committing a crime while sleepwalking is very rare. None of the people who were familiar with sleepwalking knew someone who committed a crime. And I think that's hard for someone to believe that, even jurors who knew that people sleepwalk, to believe that someone could actually commit a terrible crime like this. They also heard testimony from Dr. Pressman, who says that during sleepwalking, you can't have conscious thought, and made a big deal that in order for Ben to have stabbed his sister, he had to pull his knife out of the sheath. And Dr. Pressman testified that that was too much of a conscious thought. And yet, you and I know that there have been cases where somebody has driven and then committed a crime while sleepwalking, and the jury acquitted that person of murder.
Losing weight is one thing, but keeping it off, that's where it gets really frustrating. That's why Weight Loss by Hers now offers access to the FDA-approved Wegovy pill and the FDA-approved Wegovy pen. Wegovy is designed to help you lose weight and keep it off. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips, like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/48hours to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/48hours. forhers.com/48hours. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com. Wellness routines often fail for one simple reason, and I can speak from personal experience here. They're too complicated to stick with. Too many bottles, powders, and steps usually means they get skipped when life gets busy. Grüns is designed to simplify that. Grüns is a convenient, comprehensive formula in one delicious daily pack of gummy bears. It combines a multivitamin, green supplement, and prebiotic into one complete daily serving. Each serving comes as a daily pack of gummies because you can't fit this level of nutrition into just one gummy. It's formulated with intention, vitamins at 100% daily value, and minerals around 25% to support balanced daily nutrition. It also includes 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, which is 3 times the amount found in leading greens powders, and more than 2 cups of broccoli. Grüns ingredients are backed by over 35,000 research publications. Grüns is vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, nut-free, with no artificial colors or flavors. And it is HSA FSA eligible. Save up to 52% off with code HOURS at grüns.co. That's code HOURS at grüns.co. Welcome back. Let's dive into the really chilling body cam footage. When first responders arrive on the scene, Ben is giving Megan CPR compressions. His parents, Michael and Kathy, they are there. They are distraught. They are confused. They ask police what has happened to their daughter, Megan.
Well, Emery, at first glance, when you see that body cam footage and you see these parents asking and the police are saying, we're not going to tell you, it seems cruel at first glance, but you have to realize that they're walking into that house not knowing what happened, who exactly was involved. They just know someone inside that house was involved. Maybe they all were. And so until they could really understand what happened, they did not want to share any information. They didn't want anyone in the house sharing stories, getting a story together until they could figure out exactly what did happen. It really makes more sense when you look at it from the vantage point of these investigators walking in cold.
It does make sense. I imagine for Michael and Kathy, though, as this whole thing sort of continues to unfold, they then decide that they're going to call a family friend who happens to be an attorney. Now, prosecutors use that decision a little bit against them, frame it like it's a very suspicious thing to do.
Well, and we see this over and over again in these cases, Anne-Marie. So the family wants to know what to do. Most of the time, they've never been involved in a situation like this. So they had a friend who was a lawyer. And in fact, that lawyer helped them find out what happened to Megan. That's how they found out that their daughter had died. But then at trial, it was used against the family by the prosecution. And we see that happening over and over again in cases. The prosecutors said that the family had conducted a cover-up from the, and I'm quoting, the get-go,
right,
you know, from the very beginning. Because from the prosecution's viewpoint, if you have nothing to hide, why are you calling a friend who's a lawyer?
So Ben's family, his parents, they're already going through this heartbreaking experience. But now part of the prosecution's narrative is, and they're involved in a cover-up. Their head must have been spinning.
Well, can I just tell you, this was one of the most emotional interviews I've done with parents. As you can imagine, they have lost a daughter. They fear they'll lose their son. They, for the first time, I found out that they thought maybe he had schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. They really seemed, and they said to me, that they really wanted to know what happened. So they were very upset with the idea that anyone would accuse them of a cover-up. And they point out that Ben was willing to talk to the state's expert, sleep expert, but that the state sleeps expert did not want to talk to Ben. That expert felt he had enough information by looking at the reports and the evidence in the case and did not need to talk to Ben, is what he said to me. So the family was devastated with the claim that they were trying to cover up, because that's not how they saw it.
Mm-hmm. The jurors really got to see Ben Elliott's police interrogation. I'm curious as to, you know, what they felt about his demeanor and what you felt about his demeanor, because you spoke to him.
That's the hard part, Anne-Marie, in these cases. We are judging people by how they act under the worst moments of their lives,
yeah,
but we've never met those people before. So it's a very tough part of any criminal trial to try to figure out, how do you judge the demeanor of somebody? The Ben that I saw on police cam footage was very similar to the Ben I met when I saw him in the jail. He was a little more animated with me because apparently his grandmother was and is a fan of mine. And so he did say to me kind of that his grandmother under different circumstances would be happy to know that I was the one who interviewed him. So I saw more of a open, talkative Ben. Mm-hmm. But through most of the interview, the Ben we saw in police cam footage was pretty much the same guy I interviewed. Mm. And his parents told me the same thing, that is who he is. I did talk to him about his affect and the fact that he was talking about things that seemed so unrelated to what had just happened to his sister. You see him during the interview with the detective talking about, you know, he's just been taken from his home after stabbing his sister, and he's talking about taking his SAT. That struck me when I saw it. And he said to me that he had just shut down. He didn't want to believe that he had done what he had done to his sister, and he was trying not to think about it.
So, Aaron, the other thing that really jumped out at me, that bothered me, to tell you the truth, is that he calls his home, he calls it a crime scene. Did you get a chance to ask him, why would you call it a crime scene?
Well, I did. And his answer was because it was a crime scene. I mean, we hear him in 911 saying he stabbed, killed his sister. So he clearly thought it was a crime. He said he knew that they would cordon it off. I mean, he kind of knew what the police would do. So he did not find the fact that he had used that term unusual.
So, you know, that was just some of what the jury had to consider. But there were other pieces of evidence that swayed them. What were kind of the big pieces of evidence for the jury?
Well, you point out demeanor was a big one. The number of stab wounds, because the prosecution did make a big deal about it, and one of those wounds was very deep. And the prosecution said that that goes to the idea that he intentionally stabbed her.
Mm.
The prosecution also talked to the jurors about the fact that, according to the prosecution, there should have been blood spatter. Mm. She was stabbed in the neck, and the prosecution, and this is all just their theory, there was no proof of it, but the prosecution argued that the pillow that was near Megan had been used by Ben to keep her from yelling, and that kept blood spatter from hitting the wall. But Ben had said to use the pillow, but he says he did it to try to stop the bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
Near the end of, it was during their closing, the prosecutors told the jurors, well, we have no motive, but you never know what goes on behind closed doors. And I think that really struck the jurors.
So the jurors initially were split 7-5, but then ultimately they all come around and it's a unanimous decision, right? They find Ben Elliott guilty of first degree murder. I just thought like maybe a lesser charge would have been more appropriate, like manslaughter or something like that instead of first degree murder.
Yeah, I should also point out, so when you say 7-5, it was 7 people initially were for guilty and 5 for not guilty.
Mm.
When you see that these are young people and a young defendant, you might think, well, do you really want to do first degree murder? This is his twin. But what you have is a 17-year-old teenager who's dead, and you have 2 stab wounds. And I think the prosecutors, they believe he had the intent to kill her, and that's first degree, and that's why he was charged with that. And I should also point out with the jurors that even though there were 5 initially who thought that Ben might not be guilty, they all came around to a unanimous decision of guilt and were satisfied with that decision at the end.
Well, you say that. We know that prosecutors wanted a sentence of 40 years. But this might give us a little window into what the jury was grappling with, because a member of the jury asked for leniency. It makes you wonder.
Well, leniency, according to the juror, because he felt so bad for the parents.
Mm.
But I do want to leave you with this idea of what Ben said to me, which I thought was interesting. Ben believes that some of the jurors did have reasonable doubts. And he points out that the judge could have sentenced him to 40 years, but instead chose to sentence him to a much shorter period of time. And he said to me, if people really thought that he had killed his sister in cold blood, wouldn't they want him locked up for the rest of his life?
We'll remind people, he got a prison sentence of 15 years. That makes him eligible for parole in 2032. He will still be a young man, 28 years old, if he does get parole at that time.
And I do want to add, Anne-Marie, that Ben is appealing this verdict.
How are his parents and her parents as well, how are they coping? It occurred to me that they probably barely had a moment to sort of get over the shock of Megan's death and even begin grieving for her before they had to pivot and think about Ben.
I have not spoken to them recently, but I did speak with them this summer. And they are, as you can imagine, just devastated. Mm-hmm. When you speak with them, you can feel their pain. And they're a little bewildered to this day, wondering why there wasn't, in their mind, more of an attempt to find out what really happened in the early morning hours, to Megan. They miss Megan. They worry about Ben. They have an older daughter. And I noticed through the interview, they just held hands through the whole thing. And so I said, oh my gosh, you guys, you're getting through this together. And they said, we couldn't have gotten through it without each other. And that was very touching to me.
Absolutely. Well, this is unlike one that I've seen so far on 48 Hours. I think you're going to take the viewers on kind of a bit of a roller coaster, and I'm curious to see where everyone lands once they watch it. Thank you so much, Erin.
Thanks so much, Anne-Marie. I think we're going to have this in our hearts for a while, too.
Indeed. Before we leave, Erin, you have another podcast. Can you tell us about it?
It's called 15 Inside the Daniel Marsh Murders. This is, again, one of those cases that it's really hard to shake. This was not only a thrill killer, but he was just 15 when he killed two people that he did not know, two strangers, just to know what it felt like to kill someone. So it raises all kinds of important questions about what do you do when you have a 15-year-old killer who then is diagnosed as a psychopath? Do you keep him in prison the rest of his life? What do you do? And the impact on the victims' families. It's a very moving and chilling podcast.
So you can find 15 on your favorite podcast app. If you like this episode, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify.
I've been seeing Blue Tansy everywhere in skincare lately, but I actually discovered it through one of my favorite clean brands, Primally Pure. I didn't believe in natural deodorant until I tried their best-selling Blue Tansy deodorant. This one is actually clean, and it actually works. Blue Tansy is this really calming antioxidant that helps soothe irritation and inflammation, especially if your skin tends to react easily in areas like underarms. And what I love is that the same ingredient runs through their entire soothing collection, from facial mists when you need a little pick-me-up to their soothing spirulina face mask, packed with raw honey, kaolin clay, and wild-crafted botanicals. I've honestly never experienced anything like it. So if your skin has been feeling a little overwhelmed lately, return to calm with Primally Pure. Their Blue Tansy line is a beautiful place to start,